This is the Education Gadfly Show.
University of Michigan ex-student, not graduate, Madonna. Pretty awesome, huh?
Pretty good halftime show.
Thank you. Seriously, come on.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Eli Manning of the education policy world, Janie Skull. You like that?
Yeah, that's good.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I assume he's kind of like on top of the world right now. I think I would be.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. I mean, you know, he's pretty much a pretty cool guy there.
Yeah. I mean, it was a good game. Did you watch it?
Watched it, actually, over at Rick's house.
Very nice.
Yes,
very nice.
And he had a bunch of people over there, most of them much younger than me, but not as young as my sons who were there, too. And so it was fun. And actually had these 20-somethings hanging out with my boys. It was great. What you realize, you know, so many parents that we know are in the same boat we are, which was namely that we didn't start having kids until our mid-30s. And it is true what they say. This is something that young people are supposed to do.
So what were the young people there doing?
Well, I mean, I'm just saying they were like 15 years younger than me, and they just had energy, you know, to like run and jump and play.
They were also only with kids for, you know, an afternoon.
Yeah, that is true.
I think that's a big difference.
Yes, exactly. So I think that I'm going to start a new program for people in their 20-something, you know, 20-something people to, you know, do some more babysitting of my kids.
I thought you were going to say, like, procreating. Like, Fordham's new policy agenda, get people to have babies younger.
Well, there's that. There should be incentives in our society for that, but that's a whole other issue. But there's going to be some new Fordham policies around, you know, community service, we'll call it, aka babysitting Mike's kids. No, just kidding. All right. Hey, I got a cold, but that is not going to stop us, Janie.
Nope.
We're going to rock it today.
Yeah, you've been rousing so far, so let's keep it going.
All right. Thanks, Jane. All right, we're going to play Part of the Gadfly. We're going to hear Amber's Research Minute. We're going to hear Chris's What's Up With That. So, Ty, let's get going with Part in the Gadfly.
After Colorado legalized medical marijuana in 2009, student suspensions for drug violations have soared.
Shocking!
With dozens of dispensaries popping up within 1,000 feet of schools. How are schools supposed to cope when the government makes access to pot so easy?
I have no answer for this one. Janie, I'm not sure what they're supposed to do.
I guess the part of the question that gets me is the government makes access to pot so easy. I mean, that's, to me, the problem. Like, all right, government, crack down and don't let access to pot be so easy. If you're going to have medical marijuana, make sure you have, you know, the correct things in place so that they're not getting into the hands of high schoolers that don't have medical issues.
Yeah. So first of all, there's this issue that there's a lot of these that are popping up literally across the street from schools.
Yeah.
And so one response would be to have a rule that says, okay, you can't have a pot dispensary within 1,000 feet of schools.
I don't think that's going to make a big difference, though. It's not the, you know, convenience for the kids of, oh, I'll just walk down the street. I mean, if they had to walk a couple extra blocks, they're going to do it. Or it sounds like from this article that a lot of people are actually getting it through, you know, relatives and friends who work and are just taking things home at the end of the day, or they're standing outside and getting people to buy it as they go in. It's just, I don't think it's the location necessarily.
Right. So it's
really
not that kids are walking in the front door of these dispensaries and buying it legit.
Yeah.
I mean, there's what? They said it looked like there were a couple dozen kids in the entire state of Colorado that have a license to buy medical marijuana, and that their parents had to sign off on that.
Yeah.
Now, the rules are very loose. I mean, it doesn't mean that they all have cancer. It could mean that they have chronic pain.
Yeah.
You know, a toothache. I don't know. I don't want to judge.
Maybe that's legit. Maybe they really do have these problems and this really is the best solution and they should be allowed to have it. But there should be more things in place to make sure that it's not going through them to other kids.
This was some great reporting out there from Ed News Colorado. And I did notice some of the names of the dispensaries made me think that the medical part of their marijuana thing was not the front and center on their mind.
Well, actually, and that is an argument for not being so close to school now that I think about it, is the idea that, you know, you don't want to normalize it for kids and make it seem like it's a normal part of society that there are just these, you know, medical marijuana places everywhere and everyone goes to them. And, you know, you want to kind of separate that from the normal day-to-day life of a high school student, I think.
All right. There you go. Janie finally coming down to say no pot dispensaries across the street from schools. Topic number two.
Parents in suburban Virginia are irked that the local school district is charging them with misdemeanors if their children rack up too many absences. Is this an effective way to get parents involved, or are schools severely overreacting?
First of all, Janie, slow news week here, huh? I mean, so far we're talking about pot, and we got parents getting criminalized.
We're already on to what's up with that.
Let's face it. We're all waiting for the big news this week, which is going to come towards the end of the week, something about the waivers for ESEA. But we're just, you know, the Department of Ed has been dragging this out.
Well, then, we're just twiddling our thumbs over here.
All right, but this is it. All right, so what they're doing in Virginia, they're going and arresting parents for having their kids show up late to school or not showing up at all.
It's not arresting them. It's requiring them to come to a court date, right?
There were instances on repeat offenders where parents were arrested.
Handcuffed. All right, well, repeat offenders, like...
Yeah, mugshots, the whole thing.
I could see that being legit. I mean, if you're not getting your kid to school on time, you're not getting your kid to school on time. Is it really that hard? Set the alarm 10 minutes earlier.
Janie, you have no idea. Is it that hard to get your kid to school on time? You just wait. It's harder than it looks. I did not succeed this morning. But then again, I was walking Nico to school, and I had a suitcase. So I actually had the double stroller, Nico in one side, the suitcase in the other. It's a long story. I missed my bus. Anyways, this is not easy, okay? It's a lot of stress.
But repeatedly?
I agree. Look, this comes to the question of, again, you know, this is the public versus private purpose of schooling. I guess this, you know, look, as long as we have a policy that says kids must go to school, unless you've gone through the hoops to create your own homeschool, this is what we've got. I don't know. To me, it seems like these resources maybe would be better spent, I don't know, making the school more engaging, doing some, trying to figure out what the core issue is at the bottom of this.
I don't know. I don't think the school's going to find any program that's going to make parents be better parents, you know? It's just, if you have to scare them into it, then scare them into it.
Scared straight from Janie Skull. All right, topic number three.
The Florida Senate Education Committee approved a bill requiring school districts to share their construction and maintenance funding with charter schools. Will this put an unfair dent in district budgets, or will it even the playing field?
Well, I mean, I like the way it sounds, right, Janie?
Yeah, that's kind of what we've been hoping for a long time. That, you know.
The question here is, how do we make sure that that all public schools are on an even footing when it comes to funding, and that the money follows kids to their school of choice? And, you know, the issue with charters is that the construction money, the facilities money, almost never follows them to their school. And so even in places that have done a pretty good job making sure that both state and local resources do follow the kid, that's just for operational expenses. It's not for the facilities. And that's a big chunk of money.
Yeah.
And so you got charters out there who are, you know, scrambling to find space and spending a lot of their per pupil funding on rent or on mortgages. This could help quite a bit.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand the district side that they're suddenly left with less money, and they still basically have the same amount of bureaucracy. At least they might have left fewer kids because the kids are going to charter schools, but they still have this huge structure that needs to be supported somehow if it's going to remain how it is. But I think that's kind of the big question here: is how can they actually reduce that big bureaucracy to reduce their costs, and thus, you know.
Well, it's not just bureaucracy. I mean, the issue is, right, they lose, you know, three kids from each classroom, and it's not clear how they then deal with that issue.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
No, no, no. I understand
they can't
that,
just then collapse those classrooms, fire teachers, you know, shrink the size of their schools.
But in theory, they could. Is the thing.
Well, over time, they could learn to be more flexible. Yes. And look, what we'd really have, ideally, is we would move to a system where there was some kind of independent commission or authority that took care of the facilities, for all the facilities in an area. And then the school district and the charter schools would both contract or rent from that facility so that they really were on even playing field. And by the way, you know, school districts aren't that great at managing these facilities. I mean, we've seen these examples of incredibly expensive buildings. Do we really want a school board spending most of their time thinking about how to finance and build new schools? That doesn't, you know, it seems like you want to put that, you know, have some people in charge of that who can focus on that, who have expertise in that area, and let the education system focus on the core mission of teaching and learning.
Sounds good to me.
In other words, steal all the buildings from the public schools and give them to charters. Okay, that's all the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Would you watch that game?
I did. Are you kidding me? It was a great game.
All right. So Rick was teasing me for saying this, but is it bad for me to admit that my favorite part of the whole game was the halftime show with Madonna?
Really?
Yes.
I thought she was going to trip.
Terrible.
I know. I didn't think she was going to either.
She can't move.
Move. Oh, and those heels, God. Where you like look at her, I'm like, she's going to like eat it any second.
Did you notice that she wasn't doing much of the actual dancing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
She's like 50.
But she's Madonna. Come on. You're going to perform for the Super Bowl. You got to practice ahead of time. Make sure you can move, be a little more lively.
Yes. That's right.
Terrible.
Yes.
Strike a pose, Janie. Strike a pose.
I mean, that was kind of old school. Saying. Really? Still Madonna? We're doing Madonna in 2012? You know, I thought that was a little...
But that's what's great about Madonna is she has evolved with the times. It's like U2. They're not just playing the same stuff from way back when.
I think I would have more enjoyed if U2 had been there. Well,
that's true. All right, Amber, what you got for us this week?
We got a new study out of Calder by Mike Podgursky and colleagues. These are some friends of ours. They examine the impact of pension borders on leadership mobility. In other words, does the substantial loss of pension revenue Avenue that results when you leave one pension system for another, discourage principals from moving to other systems. So they examine 18 years of panel data from 92 to 2010, just in Missouri. Missouri's unique. They actually have three different pension systems. They've got the state system, which about 90% of educators belong, two other district-based systems in Kansas City and St. Louis, which enroll the remaining 10%. So it's kind of a unique case study. There's no reciprocity between those systems, so they kind of function the same way that a system would function across state lines, meaning they're that different. They use a simulation. I'm not going to get too much of the methods, but they use a simulation technique that addresses, among other aspects, district size and disadvantaged status. Means that they attempt to control for the fact that large city districts would be more likely to hire within based on their size already, and that low principal mobility into city districts might be because they're already less desirable places to work in the first place. Anyway, so they find that pension borders represent a substantial impediment to principal mobility. They estimate for two groups of schools that are separated by a pension border, removing that border would roughly double leadership flows between the two groups. And they also find that the borders mitigate the fact that city districts already have a really hard time recruiting quality leaders as measured by licensure test scores and the selectivity of their undergraduate institution. They conclude that how retirement benefits are structured is at odds with making the principal labor market more fluid, and they recommend that these folks be moved into mobile plans such as DC plans.
Thrilling.
I'm getting it. That's the best you got for us?
We had one SR. Our readers, our listeners are going to know what that is, but it was a little slim pickings. But yep. I mean, this was good stuff. I mean, and it reiterated the common sense notion that we have that this stuff really prevents, you know, quality people from moving around.
Well, what time of pension systems were there? The kind where you have to, you know, the defined benefit where you have to be there for 15 years before you can really take part
in
that?
I actually looked, and I was kind of disappointed because they don't really go into the nuts and bolts, but they're all DB.
Defined benefit. Yeah. So, I mean, you're right. I mean, this does sound like one of those classic studies that just tells you exactly what you would expect.
Right.
Which is that, right, if you have a huge penalty for leaving the district before your pension comes due, you don't leave.
Yeah.
And you don't come in likewise. And I guess this is what, I mean, you know, there are certainly metro areas where, you know, we're on the border between state lines here in Washington, D.C. You'd say, okay, this is probably an issue for getting principals to come from Montgomery County, Maryland into D.C. or vice versa. At least that could be a big issue because the pension systems do not cooperate with one another.
Yeah, I mean, I thought they made a good point that we've actually made some leeway in terms of making licensure more portable with teachers. I mean, remember back in the day, it was ABCTE, I forget what they said, but they were really, like, you know, getting on that. And that we've seen a lot of movement there, but not with the pension. So, I mean, obviously, it's a little more complicated than the licensure issue. But
Well, it would be interesting, though, to see whether they find the same results if they looked at a system with three, you know, defined contribution plans or just different plans where there wasn't that huge penalty. I mean, I assume it would kind of be the, like you just said, like the findings you would expect, that there was more principal mobility in a system like that. But it would be interesting to compare.
You could look at the charter school system, right? Yeah, or the private school sector, where most people have some kind of TIAA-CREF, you know, 401k kind of thing that they take with them. Right. So, yeah, then there is, you know, you look in the private school world, I think you'd see a lot more mobility among private schools. The question is, you know, they make this case for defined contribution, the 401k style plans, which is fine, and there's a lot of reasons to support that. Short of that, I do wonder if there's a way to get these state or city pensions just cooperating. So to, like, you know, transfer funds to somehow find a way to make that work a little bit better.
Or, and they said, you know, the state foot the bill for what these folks lose.
That doesn't seem like
a stretch. But,
good luck with that.
But anyway, I mean, one of the things is whether you participate in Social Security. That was one of the other things. I think it's the district systems that don't do that. So that's another sort of biggie way these programs differ.
Okay, Amber, it's that time when we have our special quiz.
So last week we asked our listeners how many states had science standards that were rated worse in 2012 than in 2005, which was the last time we rated science standards. It's piggybacked on our big science report released last week. How many states do you guys think did worse? 3, 16, 20, or 24?
I mean, 3, because I would assume most states would take our advice and make their standards better.
I'm going to say 24, because I think states are terrible at coming up with good standards.
So we're in the middle at 16. Could have been better.
It's a little misleading, though, Amber, right? Because our criteria did change, and that did, we think, drag That's down true. The score somewhat. Yes. We were tougher graders this time.
Yes, we were, indeed.
What's the question this week?
This week, we looked at some OEC data. I found this interesting. Hopefully other folks will. So our question is, which country's elementary and middle school teachers spend less than 40% of their time actively teaching? So the U.S., as a point of reference, we spend about 60% of our working time teaching every day.
Okay.
So a country spends less than 40% of their time teaching. Is this Japan, England, the Netherlands, or Germany? All right. And our listeners can go to edexcellence.net/podcast to vote.
Or slackingteachers.com to find out the answer.
That works, too.
To clear my head, telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that? What up with that? Yes,
sir. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Were you happy with the results on Sunday?
No, it was a great game and people's hearts were broken. That's all I could ask for.
You really thought it was a great game? I mean, that first half wasn't so great, right?
Yeah, but then they came back and it was like...
It was a close game.
It was a close... I mean, it was a well, hard-fought defensive game.
But back me on this one. University of Michigan, ex-student, not graduate. Madonna, pretty awesome, huh?
Pretty good halftime show.
Thank you.
Actually, I didn't think it was that great. But, you know... U of M alum Mario Manningham with that great grab at the end of the game to win it for the Giants. So.
Yeah, a big Michigan influence here. Okay, what you got for us this week, Chris?
Well, hey, Mom and Dad, are you sick and tired of how pampered kids are these days? Trying to find an elementary school that will teach your child to be independent and tough instead of coddling and babying them? Then be sure to check out Devonshire Elementary School in Skokie, Illinois, where the teachers don't encourage crying, they stifle it. Don't just take my word for it. Ask Rahul Kandani, a kindergartner currently attending Devonshire. Earlier this year, he slipped on a mound of snow and hit his head while on the playground. Rahul, who suffered a concussion, lay on the ground crying, waiting for someone to help him. His teacher, however, told him, quote, "You're a big boy. I can't carry you," and instructed him to walk back to the classroom. He proceeded to get up and walk, but fell almost instantly due to the fact that he had just broken his leg as well. That didn't seem to bother his teacher, though, as he had to crawl the remaining 200 to 300 feet back to the school building. In fact, Rahul received no medical help whatsoever from anyone at the school until his mom came to get him. What's up with that? I mean, what in God's name is going on at this school? It'd be sad if this had happened to a high schooler, but a kindergartner? What is wrong with you people? Nobody even called an ambulance. His mother saw him crawling up to the building when she came to get him from the school, and she was the one to take him to the hospital. Doctors discovered he suffered a fractured tibia and a hematoma to the head. The teacher, any supervisor on the playground, and any administrator on duty that day should instantly lose their job, and also their teaching certification. Rahul's parents are suing the district, seeking damages in excess of $200,000. I hope they get more.
Ooh, wow. So what do we know what's happened at the school? Has anybody lost their job?
No update on that front.
Yeah. Poor Rahul. What happens there? I mean, look, we have this thing in our society where I think we don't seem to trust our inner instincts anymore, Chris.
I just don't understand it, that no one would help this poor 5-6-year-old, whatever he may be. Like I said, it'd be one thing if, you know, a high schooler were lying on the ground crying, saying he had, you know, hurt his head, broken his leg. Okay, maybe you're thinking this kid's big enough, I might, you know. But he's six years old.
I mean, I can understand that a teacher, when a kid falls and cries, you know, could say, just come on, get up, like, we need to go back into school. But it seems like as soon as he stood up and fell over and clearly had a broken leg, that's when it just gets completely absurd.
It's about judgment here. I mean, look, and it's true. Little kids will cry, and you start to, you know your kids well enough, you know the fake cry. You're like, all right, come on, that's the fake cry, right? And there's also, even when they get, you know, if they fall and it looks like, ooh, like sometimes you think to yourself, ooh, that looked like that hurt. But I'm going to try not to react, because if I react, it could freak them out. And so you kind of have a, you know, down low, I'm not going to. But, you know, then if they're really hurt, you know, you sue them. Anyways, this is, wow, bad
like
judgment. You wonder what the background
crawling,
is here.
Right? Yeah. Like if they start crawling back, I mean, it would take 5 feet for me to be like, okay, that kid's actually hurt. He's crawling.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the real problem here is probably that the class size is too large.
It's tough for teachers these days, Mike, you know, with these 25, 26 size classes.
Yeah, and kids falling all over the place.
You probably couldn't see him crawling, you know, among all the other kids. Just blocking him out in the crowd.
You know, when you started this, Kristen, you talked about a tough school. I thought you were going to go into that. There's this great book out that my son enjoys called Pirate School. It is about, these pirates that create a school for kids. Actually sounds like a great idea for a summer camp or something like that. Awesome. And eventually there's a mutiny. It's very exciting. Check it out at your local library. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And remember, if you like what you heard during the podcast, head to edexcellence.net/podcast to find links and more about this episode and to vote on Amber's question. It's a lot of fun. You get to click something and vote and find out next week if you were right. Okay, until then.
I'm Janie Skull.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.